Tonight, casino billionaire Steve Wynn is out as RNC finance chair in the wake of a sexual misconduct scandal. Days after the government shutdown, President Trump prepares for his State of the Union address. We get a first look. A massacre in the crowded streets of Kabul after an ambulance is turned into a weapon. We go inside North Korea, where 50 years later, a captured American Navy ship is still on display as a symbol of defiance against the U.S. And how one young engineer is breaking the mold in the automobile industry.
This is NBC Nightly News with Jose Diaz-Balart.
Good evening tonight. A shakeup at the Republican National Committee. Finance chair, casino mogul Steve Wynn, a key Republican donor, stepping down after reports of years of sexual misconduct. Wynn categorically denies all claims, but late this afternoon quit his post at the RNC, a position he was handpicked for by President Trump. This is the latest in a wave of high-profile men accused of sexual misconduct. Matt Bradley has the latest.
A casino king resigning amid scandal. Las Vegas icon Steve Wynn stepped down today as Republican Party finance chair, one day after an explosive Wall Street Journal expose accusing Wynn of sexual misconduct, an allegation Wynn called preposterous. Wynn donated to both parties, but was a top Republican donor. And close to the president.
Steve Wynn, would you stand up? He's raising so much money for our great Republican Party.
According to the Journal, Wynn paid a $7.5 million settlement to an unnamed manicurist who accused Wynn of forcing her to have sex in 2005. Court documents cited by the Journal point to personal misconduct, but do not state whether it was of a sexual nature. Wynn Resorts say they've never received any complaints, but according to the paper, it's one of more than a dozen claims of sexual misconduct.
There was a level of intimidation with Steve Wynn as being the boss of the company.
Today, a billionaire has lost a top political post. No word yet on whether Republicans will return the money. Matt Bradley, NBC News.
We are getting our first look at what President Trump will say at his State of the Union address this week. He is expected to focus on his priorities, including the economy and overhauling immigration. Here's White House correspondent Kristen Welker.
Poised to address a deeply divided nation at his first State of the Union address Tuesday, President Trump will aim to strike a tone of unity, echoing the optimism from his joint address to Congress last year.
A new chapter of American greatness is now beginning.
In a preview, one senior administration official says the theme this year, building a safe, strong, and proud America. The president preparing to highlight four key points, jobs in the economy, with a focus on his tax victory.
It's the largest tax cut in the history of our country.
The president expected to press Congress to pass a $1 trillion infrastructure package, and he'll call for immigration reform after rolling out a plan this week that offers dreamers a path to citizenship, along with border wall funding.
This should be a bill of love.
Another key focus, national security, making his case for a stronger military, more secure borders, and a tough approach to North Korea.
We will defend our common security.
The president will deliver the address in the shadow of the escalating Russia probe. Just today, CNN reporting that Mr. Trump's privately been venting about Rod Rosenstein, his deputy attorney general. The president's counsel on Russia, Ty Cobb, calling that one of an onslaught of false stories, all setting up an historic moment with high stakes.
Gives him a chance to make a case for his administration's achievements, particularly on tax reform, lay out a roadmap for the year ahead without having to talk about Russia.
Before the president delivers the State of the Union Tuesday, a big meeting here at the White House on Monday. Mr. Trump will host diplomats with the UN Security Council, the focus Iran. It will be the second meeting of its kind since Mr. Trump took office, Jose.
Kristen Welker at the White House, thank you. In Afghanistan today, there was a deadly explosion in central Kabul. A suicide bomber used an ambulance as a weapon. The attacker killed at least 95 people, injured more than 150. There are fears the death toll will rise. Here's Lucy Kafanoff with the latest.
carnage on the streets of Kabul, the chaotic aftermath of a suicide attack. The weapon, an ambulance packed with explosives, targeting a heavily guarded street near embassies and government buildings. The driver got past the security checkpoint by saying he was taking a patient to a hospital. There was panic as people ran for their lives. The wounded rushed to nearby hospitals, soon overwhelmed. Some of the victims were children. The Red Cross tweeting, "Ambulances are for saving lives, not destroying them." The Taliban claimed responsibility for the massacre. It's the second attack on the capital in a week. Taliban battled security forces for hours at a luxury hotel in Kabul. Americans were among the 22 people killed. And on Wednesday, 90 miles east in Jalalabad, ISIS claimed responsibility for an attack on an aid office for children. Four people were killed. As Kabul prepares to mourn its dead, many are asking when the violence will end. Lucy Kafanov, NBC News.
We turn now to Paris, where tonight the Eiffel Tower has gone dark to pay tribute to the victims of the Kabul attack. This as the city anxiously watches as floodwaters from weeks of heavy rain continue to rise, nearing record levels and threatening more and more of the city. We get this report from Kelly Kobieya in Paris.
Paris is on pins and needles tonight, watching the iconic Seine River inch higher, with parks already waterlogged and the world-famous museums on high alert. The Louvre has already sealed off its lower floor and checked emergency plans for the Mona Lisa and Venus de Milo. Boat tours canceled, entire neighborhoods are washed out, more than 600 residents evacuated. Caroline Austin's family forced to walk on planks if they want to go anywhere.
We maybe had one day in December where it didn't rain, and that was it.
That's bad.
It rains every day.
The last time it was this bad was in 2016. Museums were forced to move art to higher ground, the river swamping this landmark statue then. Now, it's rising again as Paris hopes to keep its head well above water. Tonight, the river is expected to rise a few more inches, cresting at just under 20 feet. But water is already seeping into basements along the riverbank, and more rain is on the way. Jose.
Kelly Kobieya in Paris, thank you. New fallout in the wake of the Larry Nassar sex abuse scandal that rocked USA Gymnastics. Michigan's attorney general announced today he's appointed a special prosecutor to investigate the university where Nassar abused girls and young women for years. Maya Rodriguez has the details.
Tonight, Michigan State University on notice.
Who at Michigan State knew or was aware of what he was doing because they had been told by some of these victims?
The state's attorney general launching an investigation into the university that employed Larry Nassar, the former USA Gymnastics team doctor who dozens of women say sexually abused them.
These were young girls who were robbed of their innocence in the most tender of years.
The move comes after Michigan State's president and athletic director resigned after more than 100 young women spoke out during Nassar's sentencing.
Larry, to me, you are the worst type of person.
Among them, gymnast Lindsay Lemke, who says Nassar molested her hundreds of times.
I had all of my feelings to let out without him saying anything back, so by the end of the speech, I felt very powerful.
Michigan State would not comment on today's announcement, pointing to an earlier statement acknowledging failures at MSU, adding they have asked for the attorney general to investigate and will cooperate. This as the remaining board members for USA Gymnastics announced they will all resign by next Wednesday.
Now they need to make a whole new plan of what they're going to do when something happens along the lines of sexual assault.
Now with added scrutiny on the university that also employed Nassar. Another turn in a scandal that has rocked the school and the world of gymnastics. Maya Rodriguez, NBC News.
It has been more than 4 months since Hurricane Maria devastated Puerto Rico. The island's still recovering, and tonight we're looking at the impact on its students. Thousands have fled Puerto Rico to start over at schools across the United States. NBC's Gabe Gutierrez reports.
11-year-old Gerald Betancourt Ramos is a long way from home.
Easiest, go find.
English class is difficult, he says. The sixth grader now lives in Boston after fleeing Puerto Rico. Hurricane Maria flooded his home more than 4 months ago. His mother, Tamika Ramos, left her nursing job behind.
There was no food. There was no refrigerators, no light. And with three kids, it's not easy. And so I just had to leave.
Gerald is among the 180 Puerto Rican students now enrolled in Boston public schools.
What we wanted to do is make sure they were welcomed and they felt safe. We wanted to bear hug them when they came in.
Thousands of students from Puerto Rico have relocated as far away as New York, Orlando, even Bismarck, North Dakota. On the island, cheers broke out at this private school in San Juan when the lights finally came back on recently.
We were like, woo!
10th grader Malin Suarez was especially thrilled since she still has no electricity at home.
All the lights came in and the first thought was we're finally going to have air conditioner.
Principal Josue Gomez told us that more than 60 of his students have left, crippling his budget.
Every school in the island has dealing with the same situation, losing students, losing people, losing family.
But teacher at Hirose Baez has chosen to stay.
You understand why parents are choosing to leave, but, I mean, I have to work with the ones that I still have, and I have to make them, like, want to stay.
In the months after Maria, the hardest lessons are still being learned outside the classroom. Gabe Gutierrez, NBC News, San Juan, Puerto Rico.
This week marks 50 years since the American Navy ship, the USS Pueblo, was seized by North Korea. The sailors were taken prisoner by the regime of Kim Jong-un's grandfather. That's the same family that rules to this day. The anniversary comes at a time when tensions between the U.S. and North Korea remain high. Keir Simmons went inside North Korea to file this report.
Inside North Korea, an American Navy intelligence ship captured 50 years ago. Still on display here, a window into the past that still haunts retired Marine Sergeant Bob Chicker.
All of a sudden, something hits and holy cow.
On January 23rd, 1968, Chicker was taken prisoner while on the USS Pueblo, 14 miles from North Korean land. He remembers the ship surrounded and taking fire.
It happens so fast, you don't know what's going on. It blew me off my feet.
One crew member was killed in the attack, 82 others taken as prisoners.
U.S. negotiators met for the third time today with North Korean communists at Panmunjom.
11 months of torture followed.
They kicked me a lot, and it caused a lot of problems.
The USS Pueblo is now part of a North Korean war museum. Inside the ship, artifacts frozen in time. A hallway scarred by shrapnel.
In this room, you will see the pictures of officers and their confessions.
And propaganda. The American crew fought back in their own ways, some extending their middle fingers in photos like this one. Freedom came in December 1968. The men walked one by one across the bridge of no return into South Korea.
When you're just a little bit from the other side, you get this one's for real. This one's for real, and you're getting out.
The capture of the USS Pueblo brought America and North Korea close to another full-scale conflict. If history repeats itself, perhaps there are some lessons here for today. The ship is now a Cold War trophy, and for the people here, it's seen as a symbol of strength against the U.S.
Trump, if he really provoked the Korean War against our country, then we're going to achieve our final victory.
It depends on the American president.
Yes.
50 years after the USS Pueblo was captured on high seas, an undercurrent of old hostilities remain. And today's tense standoff between North Korea and the US leaves many wondering whether war can be avoided once again. Keir Simmons, NBC News, Pyongyang, North Korea.
Still ahead tonight, a new warning about the dangers of taking hard hits on the football field. Also, how discarded Christmas trees are coming to Louisiana's rescue. This week, lawmakers in Illinois and New York introduced legislation that would ban tackle football for kids younger than 12 years old. This on the heels of a new study that shows it may only take repeated hits, not necessarily a concussion, to trigger the degenerative brain disease known as CTE. Morgan Radford has this report.
14-year-old Dean Zilberman has wanted to play football since he was 8.
I really love playing, so, and, like, tackle is, like, the real deal.
But if his mom has anything to do with it, he never will.
Oh, I'm the least popular person in the house.
Diane Hess is one of the growing number of parents saying no to football.
Why would I risk his brain that is just developing for something that I didn't believe in?
A new study shows that CTE, a degenerative brain disease, can be caused by any hits to the head, not just concussions, meaning kids playing contact sports like tackle football can suffer permanent damage that could lead to dementia later in life or death.
This is about not getting hit in the head, particularly in youngsters and in other vulnerable populations who are at risk for head injuries.
Researchers studied the brains of 202 deceased football players and found that 88% were diagnosed with CTE. Nick Bonaconte is a former NFL linebacker who doctors estimate took over 10,000 hits to the head before he was in high school. Now they believe he has CTE.
I can't concentrate. I can't read the newspaper. I can't read a book. I can't believe that any parent would let their child go out and play football, contact football.
The NFL says that it has been proactive in emphasizing safety first, and the nation's largest youth football organization says experiences and memories from playing this great team sport far outweigh the risks. But parents like Diane say they're not taking any chances, especially with their kids.
What do you want to be when you grow up?
Sports agent.
Football agent?
Yeah.
I'm ruining his career.
I have a feeling he'll be good.
Industry researchers say participation in tackle football for boys between 6 and 12 has fallen by nearly 20% in just the last 9 years. And doctors say it's not just tackle football that parents really need to be concerned about. It's also lacrosse, soccer, or really any contact sport that exposes kids to head injury while their brains are still developing, Jose.
Morgan Radford, thank you very much. We are back in a moment with how Christmas trees are helping to rebuild the Gulf Coast. Can you believe we're almost in February? So by now, you're probably gotten rid of your Christmas tree. But have you ever thought about where those trees go after you put it out on the curb? For many, it's the landfill. Well, our Carrie Sanders discovered a place where they found a creative way to give dead Christmas trees new life and help rescue the coastline at the same time.
In Louisiana, a race against time.
The tide comes up and we flood much easier now. So those things scare me.
The coast slipping away, with erosion claiming new ground every minute. For homeowners, growing concern.
Originally, this house was probably at this elevation.
But in this slow-motion crisis, Christmas trees here have come to the rescue, giving a second life to holiday treasures that in the rest of the country are trashed each year.
But this is like a mountain of trees.
It's a mountain of trees.
For the last three decades, every January, thousands of discarded Christmas trees are dropped or ferried off the coast, all placed inside so-called cribs.
We're saving coastal Louisiana right now by putting trees out on the marsh.
The trees create a line of defense, a break against waves, and below the surface, branches capture sediment, building something akin to an underwater protective sandbar.
100 years ago, right where I'm standing, this was land. Ranchers actually had cattle penned here. Erosion then began over the decades to steal away the land, turning this into a marshland filled with birds and foliage. And now, as you can see, it's become a lake. The wetlands are still disappearing at an alarming rate. A football field gone every hour.
A snapshot of the success? Goose Bayou. For the last 20 years, with Christmas trees, only 3 acres lost. Where there were none, 23 acres gone. Statewide, 25 miles of coast disappear every year.
If a foreign country came here and occupied 25 square miles of land anywhere in the United States, the country would declare war on that country.
The Louisiana coastline now protected, at least here, under the Christmas tree. Kerry Sanders, NBC News, Jean Lafitte, Louisiana.
When we come back, why this young engineer who doesn't even drive is being called the future of the auto industry. Finally tonight, we're going to introduce you to a young woman who's breaking barriers and shaping the future of the auto industry. Katie Beck takes us to meet one rising star.
At Ford's Design Center, a new prototype is in the works. It isn't being drafted at this desk. She's sitting behind it.
I'm passionate about what I'm doing and basically living my dream life.
24-year-old Victoria Shine breaks the mold of what most would picture an auto engineer to look like. Pictures from her childhood show an early drive to work with cars.
My neighbors would take me on test drives around the neighborhood block and in their cars.
Before she could read, she was studying auto magazines. In less than 2 years at Ford, she's credited with 40 patents, like this Bluetooth button to reduce distracted driving.
And it can control things without you having to touch your phone.
The most surprising fact about Victoria, she doesn't have a driver's license, which allows her to study cars from the outside, finding inspiration on her way to work.
I'll write this new idea down and go try and develop it.
Designing cars with the help of young creatives like her, a new focus for Ford.
So you think when the 24-year-old speaks in the room, they're listening?
They're listening, yeah.
Looking for millennial innovators to keep up with tech competitors like Google and Uber.
It's not just the hard technical skills that we're screening for. It's also the behaviors and the personality.
Ingenuity on overdrive.
It makes me want to change the world.
Finding ways forward for the auto industry. A young engineer's dream job come true. Katie Beck, NBC News, Detroit, Michigan.
And that's NBC Nightly News for this Saturday. I'm Jose Diaz-Balart reporting from New York. Thank you for the privilege of your time, and good night.